Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. Supreme Court is back in session. The 9-member panel typically hears 75 to 100 cases a year. This term, the court is deciding cases involving issues of free speech, separation of church and state, gun rights, and whether it's constitutional to impose a life sentence for crimes committed by juveniles. Joining me in the studio to look at what's ahead for the nation's highest court, Jeffrey Rosen is law professor at George Washington University. Let's see, we've got David Savage of the Los Angeles Times and Barry Friedman. He's a professor at New York University Law School and author of a new book. It's titled The Will of the People, How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Good morning.
Jeffrey Rosen, if I could start with you, let's talk about the Citizens United v. the Federal Elections Commission.
Well, this is a very interesting case that goes to the heart of the future of campaign finance reform. The question is whether Congress can ban campaign speech that's funded by corporations. And since the 1990s, the court has said that corporate expenditures can be banned. The case involves a documentary called Hillary, the Movie. It was an anti-Hillary Clinton documentary produced during the primaries, funded partly with corporate money by a corporation called Citizens United, which is an ideological corporation. Now, the court could have decided the case narrowly, and in fact, last spring, it examined the possibility of saying, well, maybe Congress didn't mean to ban documentaries that were funded by ideological corporations. Really, it was just General Motors that they wanted to ban. But in an unusual move, the court asked for a new argument a few weeks ago on the question of whether it should overturn its precedent saying that corporate expenditures could, in fact, be restricted, perhaps calling into question bans on corporate speech that date back to 1907 and certainly to the 1940s. And what made the argument so interesting was this possibility that the five conservatives, who so long posed as champions of minimalistic decisions, deference to legislatures and upholding precedents, might really throw the campaign system into chaos by overturning these questions. The liberals were more skeptical, and in one of the most intriguing questions, Justice Sotomayor, in one of her first questions on the bench, said, why do we treat corporations as persons anyway? We've said that ever since the late 19th century. Maybe that decision was wrong and we should reexamine it, suggesting that she might be the first economic populist we've had on the court for a very long time.
She certainly wasn't a quiet justice in her first few days on the court.
She was not at all. She jumped right in during that first argument. During this week, she's been extremely confident. This on the Second Circuit also, she was very active questioner. Some lawyers complained she was a little bit too active, but no question that she's gotten right in with her sea legs.
Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University. He's the author of The Supreme Court, The Most Democratic Branch, The Naked Crowd, and The Unwanted Gaze. Turning to you now, David Savage, what about McDonald v. Chicago? That's one where local gun laws are brought into question.
Yes, this is the question of whether the Second Amendment limits municipal and state gun laws. It's a potentially big deal. The likelihood is the court's going to say yes. You remember a year ago, the court said in a D.C. case that they struck down the handgun ban here in the District of Columbia and said you have basically a right to have a gun at home for self-defense. Now, most Americans probably heard that and thought, well, that settles that. But this is an issue where it's a simple question and a lot of history, because for most of American history, the Bill of Rights limited only the national government. You know, it says, the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law. Well, most people, you know, were This debate really played out in the 1930s and up to the 60s, where the court said the fundamental rights, like freedom of speech, limit not just the national government, but states and locals. During that time, the Second Amendment sort of fell by the wayside. There weren't any Second Amendment cases. So this issue was left over from last year. That is, does the Second Amendment also limit state and local gun control laws? If the court says yes, which is likely in this Chicago case, then we're going to start down the road to say, what's the Second Amendment really about? Is the Second Amendment right to have a gun similar to the First Amendment right to free speech? And if it's that, then there's a whole lot of other laws that could be in danger.
And maybe it's time to have that debate.
I think that's the debate that follows immediately after this. Once they say it applies to state and locals, then there's a whole lot of other potential laws that could be challenged.
David Savage, he's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Then, Barry Friedman, there's a case involving animal cruelty, U.S. v. Stevens.
Yes, this is an interesting case. There's a congressional law that says that it's unlawful for somebody to produce or distribute materials that are going to be shipped in interstate commerce that show depictions of animal cruelty. And the film in at issue in the case is one that shows pit bulls fighting. The claim in the case is that the statute violates the First Amendment, which protects freedom of speech, that it's impermissible to ban this entire category of free speech. And the claim is it would cover a lot more than sort of naked cruelty, that it would involve all kinds of Discovery Channel and whatnot. The interesting part of the case is how far the court will go. The reports from the or whether the court will buy this. The reports from the argument is the court was extremely skeptical that this was a constitutional law. It's very, very few categories of speech that the Supreme Court has said are simply outside of the First Amendment. So the most notable recent one would be child pornography. And the question is whether you can draw an analogy that there's the same sort of evils in animal cruelty that you have in child pornography. And the guess is that the court's going to say no and that this simply can't be banned.
But this got into some pretty ugly examples, you all have to admit.
It's not the kind of thing that you actually want to sit and watch to have to figure out what the First Amendment protects, but as one of the arguments made was that the folks that are in favor of protecting animal rights and that are against animal cruelty, many of their videos will show the same sort of animal cruelty. The message will just be the opposite.
But it also got into the potential for showing human cruelty as well, David Savage.
That was the most interesting hypothetical. The government, you know, somewhere you knew it was going to come up in the argument. Somebody says, well, what about, suppose there really were snuff films where humans were killed. Sam Alito then pressed the question and said, suppose there was something, you know, overseas, outside the control of U.S., there were actually human sacrifice programs, and they were popular. Could the government ban those? Well, the attorney for the dog fighting, the guy who made the dog fighting videos said, essentially, no. You can, the government can ban a horrible, repulsive conduct, but you can't stop just videos and depictions of it. And that's the really hard part of this case.
Whoa.
Yes, that's the hard part of this case, is because all these free speech advocates want to say, look, we're just talking about videos. You can't ban that. And this is the one that really puts the court to the test of saying, are you really going to say that something like the Human Sacrifice Channel cannot be banned?
You know why that was so interesting? The Deputy Solicitor General, Neil Katyal, said, well, that would be a historical exemption. And Justice Scalia says, oh, just because you put on Roman costumes, you know, that makes it okay. What neither side was willing to admit was that the reason people want to ban this stuff is because they think it's immoral. It's absolutely immoral to sacrifice humans or to crush animals. But the government didn't want to get into that because the Supreme Court, in a case involving gay rights a few years ago, called into question the idea that you could ban conduct merely because it's immoral. And Justice Scalia said this is the end of morals legislation. The Obama administration doesn't want to be on the side of banning things that people find offensive, and the free speech people didn't either. So in some ways they were, you know, playing Hamlet without the prince.
On the other hand, Barry Friedman, going to the title of your book, The Will of the People, How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Court. This whole question of the spread of violence in our society. This young man For example, in Chicago, 14-year-old just murdered by his classmates. One has to wonder whether you have a connection in the minds of the general public between the kinds of films that the Supreme Court is saying, oh, we won't touch, and the kind of violence that acts itself out in society.
Yeah, I was struck following the argument and the case at how animal rights actually may be something that hasn't quite come to the top of the public consciousness, that there's a big movement to care about this, but the justices may be the last to get the word. You know, it's often the case when the Supreme Court steps its toe into the water for the first time that it sort of is a focal point for public opinion. People then really start to focus on the issue. So Bowers versus Hardwick, the first gay rights case, the court rules against gay rights, and then we go through 20 years and the court turns around. So this might be the first stab at animal cruelty, and we might get a decision that says that the First Amendment protects the speech and the government can't ban it. But that's going to probably open up a big discussion, I think, among the general public about what the government should be able to ban regarding animal cruelty.
David.
I do think this is one of those issues in line with sort of Barry's book about public opinion. I got an awful lot of emails of people saying, being outraged and saying, how in the world could you think crushing little animals is protected by the First Amendment? Yet there was a whole group of organizations, people we know, movie makers, photographers, journalists, all those people were on the side of saying, oh, the First Amendment, free speech, you can't limit free speech.
You know,
so that's the divide.
Even talking about it makes me sick. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, your calls, questions, stay with us. And we're back talking about the current session of the U.S. Supreme Court with a brand new justice sitting, Sonia Sotomayor. We have with us Jeffrey Rosen, George Washington University, David Savage of the L.A. Times, Barry Friedman of New York University School of Law. Do join us, 800-433-8850, your email to drshow@wamu.org. Clearly, great many more of you want to talk about this case, U.S. v. Stevens, involving animal cruelty. We'll come back to that. But first, let's talk about this Cross in the Desert case and Barry Friedman. I'd like to hear about that one.
It's an interesting case. The court over and over gets cases about monuments on public grounds that involve religious depictions, and this involves a cross out in the desert that's been there for years and years, and there's been a struggle about whether it's appropriately there. The case is unusual for a couple of reasons. I think the most interesting of those is that the person complaining about the cross isn't saying that the cross shouldn't be there because it's a religious symbol. He's saying that the Park Service should be open to having other religious symbols, for example, a Buddhist temple or a Buddhist symbol. So that's the issue in that case. The other interesting question in the case is that Congress, in an attempt to save the cross over time, transferred ownership away from the Park Service. And so the question is whether this effectively does the trick of saving it from the government making a statement about religion by transferring it to a private group.
Jeffrey.
And interestingly, you had, again, the Obama administration standing up and arguing on what seemed to be a relatively conservative position, which is that this cross transfer did not violate the separation of church and state and was entirely valid. And this is part of a pattern of cases. Last term, the Obama Solicitor General's office defended the idea that there is not a constitutional right to DNA evidence that might exonerate you. They won that by a 5-4 majority with the conservatives ruling for them. But they would say it's not their fault because they're supposed to defend federal laws, whether they like them or not. So here Congress chose to do this unusual cross transfer, and they were merely standing up for federal power in this case.
David.
There was one really sharp exchange yesterday, and it sort of goes to the question of what is the cross? There was this debate about whether the cross represents all war dead or it's a Christian symbol. The attorney arguing for the ACLU said, well, you know, I've been to a lot of Jewish cemeteries and there are no crosses on those. He was saying, you know, the cross is a Christian symbol. It's unavoidably a Christian symbol. Mm-hmm. Justice Scalia took great offense. He said that's an outrageous conclusion, that everybody knows the cross is a common symbol to honor all war dead. And there was really quite a sharp exchange back and forth. They didn't settle that, but in the end, that's part of what the issue is. What is the cross? Does it really represent all war dead, or is it just a Christian symbol?
What do we have at Arlington Cemetery, Barry Friedman?
I mean, there's two interesting problems with what Justice Scalia said. The first, of course, is that there are plenty of war dead who were not Christians and don't have crosses over their final resting places. The other is you'll notice that in this effort to accommodate religion in the public sphere, often those who are in favor of religion have had to diminish the religious nature of the symbols. So crosses don't stand for the Christian faith anymore, and the same's happened with Christmas trees. It's sort of an interesting line to take, this dumbing down of the religious symbolism of the symbol just to uphold the principle that it can be on government land.
The most famous example of that was the three plastic wishing well rule, that basically you could have a creche, but only when it was surrounded by a tacky reindeer and other things. There's a deep divide on this court. Justice Scalia, and it appears that most of the other conservatives embrace a position of religious supremacism. They think it's fine for the government to endorse religion over irreligion as long as they're not favoring one particular religion. And the liberals stand for separation of church and state. That question was dodged in this argument, but it is a little surprising, as Barry says, for Scalia to pretend that this didn't have sectarian meaning. His real goal is the open endorsement of the religious state, which he thinks is fine.
You're right to mention the Arlington Cemetery, Diane, because one of the real issues in this case is the VFW and the other groups say, look, if you strike down this cross and say this cross can't be in the Mojave National Forest, what do you do about the Argonne Cross at Arlington? The ACLU lawyer said, look, we're not challenging there are a lot of crosses of different faiths, but there could be litigation involving a giant cross at the front of a cemetery.
But what about this question of transferring this land and making sure then that you're not violating anything because it's not on federal land?
The government said that once the land was transferred, you're not violating anything. Justice Breyer was not convinced by this, and he thought that the injunction that forbade the government from displaying the cross remained in force even after the land had been transferred, since the injunction hadn't been lifted. So that would be a technical way of ruling against the government, but he'd basically say, until there's a new injunction, the government has to continue to cover up the cross, even though no one can see it. Just General Kagan, the Solicitor General, said, I drove out to the Mojave Desert a few weeks ago, and you really cannot see this cross from the road. And there are a lot of private spaces with crosses. So it's not as if, this is not like the Ten Commandments case where you've got a huge monument in a park that many people can see.
So, Barry Friedman, give me your idea about how this case is going to go, considering how the arguments were made.
I'm not really sure how the case is going to go. It's possible that the court will duck the case altogether by holding that this individual doesn't have standing to raise the claim about the cross because he doesn't have a religious objection to the cross. And there have been a number of cases in recent years where the court has tried hard to cut back on the number of people that can raise these complaints. You understand that when you cut back on the number of people that can raise the complaints, that's another way of protecting the religious imagery in the public sphere, because people simply can't complain about it. If they get past that, then I actually don't have a guess as to how they're going to go in this case. I think it's tough.
I think the likelihood is that they will buy the government's argument and say, once Congress transferred this parcel of land to private, that's the end of the matter, and we don't need to rule on the harder issue. This is no longer on government land, and that's a way to get rid of this case without doing anything too big.
All right. There is another important case, Graham v. Florida, Sullivan v. Florida. Both raise the question of whether it's cruel and unusual to send juveniles to life in prison without possibility of parole for crimes in which no one dies. Jeffrey?
Yes, indeed. In the Sullivan case, the defendant committed a rape at the age of 13. In the Graham case, the defendant committed an armed robbery at 16. And this is a case that resurrects a big battle that the court had just a few years ago in 2005, which is, does the Eighth Amendment restrict the execution of juvenile offenders? In that 2005 case called Ropers versus Simmons, the court cited international law and said that most countries don't execute juveniles. This, as you can expect, made Justice Scalia's head explode. He thinks, like many conservatives, that you should not cite international law to decide what the Eighth Amendment says we, the people of the United States, believe is cruel and unusual punishment. Justice Kennedy also cited brain scan evidence to suggest that adolescent minds are not fully formed and adolescents can't control themselves. The dissenter said, well, this is bleedingly obvious as any parent of a teenager knows, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be held accountable for your actions. So that was a 5-4 decision. Justice Kennedy there counted up the number of states that allowed the execution of juveniles and found an emerging consensus against this. And once again, in these cases, the court may count up the states, and this will be a chance to see whether Justice Sotomayor, as expected, agrees with Justice Souter that emerging consensus might be detected in a rather generous spirit, and therefore the law should be struck down.
You know, until this case came along, Diane, I didn't know there was such a thing as life in prison without the possibility of parole for a young teenager who commits a crime like a burglary that where no one dies. I think I knew that there were situations where if you're involved in a murder and you're 17, you get life without parole, but I didn't realize that there were such sentences. There's 109 persons in the United States under those sentences. 77 are in Florida. People tell me the Florida legislature never actually passed a law to allow this. What they allowed in the 90s, when there were several publicized crimes involving tourists there, they allowed juveniles to be charged as adults. And then some judges decided, basically, this young man at 15 or 16 is incorrigible. He's just going to keep commit crimes one after another, and I'm going to send him to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that's what they're asking the court to say is unconstitutional. 20-year sentence for armed burglary is a pretty good sentence, pretty strong sentence. But that at some point in your life,
you should have
a chance to have a parole hearing and say, this young man is now 36 or 46, he's no longer a danger.
Barry Friedman, what exactly did Graham and Sullivan do?
So just to elaborate on what Jeffrey said, one of them was a 13-year-old who was convicted of a sex crime, and that was his only offense.
What kind of a sex crime?
I don't know the answer to that.
I think a rape.
Rape?
Yeah. A rape?
I do.
Okay.
I do. What happened was they broke into an older woman's home, and an elderly woman was raped.
There
were three young guys who were involved in this. Nobody knows who did it. She testified, and there was a blanket over her head. She testified in court, a one-day hearing, that the voice sounded like the 13-year-old.
I see.
One-day hearing in 1989, 13 years old, life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Now, was that Graham or Sullivan?
That was Sullivan.
All right. What about Graham?
And Graham was more of a recidivist. It was a young man who I believe had been convicted when he was 16 of burglary, and then there was an armed robbery after that. Was that
an armed burglary of a restaurant? One of the other young guys hit the restaurant manager over the head, not Graham. That young man got a 3-year term. Graham violated his parole the next year, and the judge gave him life in prison. And, you know, another interesting fact about this case, the prosecutor asked for 4 years. The judge gave him life.
Wow.
Of course, there's a national debate about this. California, ordered by a 3-judge panel to reduce its prison population, has just eliminated the rule that parole violators 100% have to go to jail and now made possible treatment as opposed to mandatory jail. 70% of the California jail sentences are parole violators. The trend in this country is against these punitive life sentences for parole violation, and the court might take that sort of thing into account when trying to figure out whether there's an emerging consensus.
So how did you all hear the arguments yesterday or when they were placed?
On the juvenile case?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. That doesn't come up till – that's still ahead. That's in early November.
And how do you see Sotomayor going in this kind of situation?
My hunch is that she'll be with the liberals on this question. She's a former prosecutor. There are a lot of cases involving search and seizures and evidence where she's fairly conservative. But she had a number of cases where young guys were getting very stiff sentences for drug crimes, and she was more inclined to say that sentence is way too harsh. And so my guess is this will be a 5-4 split, but that she'll be on the side that says this is, for anybody who's not in Florida, this sure sounds cruel and unusual.
Barry.
There's, you know, the court's taken a lot of criminal cases this term. I think its docket is mostly made up of business cases and criminal cases. And there are, in fact, 3 cases alone about what the ruling in Miranda versus Arizona means. Miranda, if anybody watches television, they know Miranda are the warnings that get read to a suspect. And this is an ongoing fight on the court between the left and the right about how to cut back on Miranda. And on cases like that, I think we can expect her to be more conservative.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Barry, I want to ask you about your book, The Will of the People, and how you believe public opinion is affecting the judgments of the Supreme Court.
So often when we think about the court, we think of them as folks who, I mean, they are not elected. It's impossible to remove them from office except impeachment, and that's never happened. And so we often think with the court that we take what they hand us, that what you see is what you get, and there's nothing to be done about it. What I try to show in the book is that over time, the court is actually forced to come into line with popular opinion, that there's a dialogue that goes on between the court and the general public about what the Constitution means. And in areas like the death penalty, gay rights, abortion, over time, the court tends to come into line with what it is that the public thinks.
I'd like to put in a plug for Barry's wonderful book, which is absolutely the best narrative history of exactly how the court has, in fact, responded to public opinion over time. And I entirely agree with his broad thesis. However, it's not clear that in the short term, this Roberts Court might not make some real trouble and clash with public opinion. Barry just wrote a very excellent piece in the New Republic and in my magazine saying that the court doesn't matter, basically. It's just going to, on the margins, may make some trouble, but essentially follow the public will. Well, we could imagine a different scenario. Imagine this court, which it might do, strikes down campaign finance reform, throwing our political system into chaos. Last term, it decided at the last minute not to strike down the Federal Voting Rights Act, which was endorsed by a bipartisan majority. But that case may come before it again, and the act of judicial statesmanship that the liberals and conservatives pulled off might collapse. You can imagine. And finally, there are these business cases that are coming before the court. And although broadly, you don't imagine this court challenging the core of President Obama's recovery program, because they are essentially pro-business conservatives and liberals. Only Justice Clarence Thomas is a real libertarian who wants to challenge the regulatory state at its core. Nevertheless, you could have this term or later cases that raise sufficient question about the structure of some of these recovery agencies, too much delegation, not enough supervision, that they could create some real headaches for Obama in the short term. So Barry's right in the big picture, but we may see some mischief in the short term.
You know, I agree and disagree with Jeffrey both. We've talked about these things a good number of times. The he, he points out that the court ducked the voting rights case last term. They stepped away from what could have been real trouble. I think on the campaign finance case, they're likely to strike down this congressional law. Or at least there's a decent chance of it. But it's interesting to think about why that might happen. And I think the reason is that this is an issue that splits the left. So we know that the right would like to dispose of that law. On the left, some people would like to keep all of this money out of politics, but others worry about the free speech interests. It's just like the animal cruelty case. It's another case where you split the left because some care about animal rights and some are concerned about the First Amendment.
And there's also another free speech case involving Choose Life Illinois license plates, which is a fascinating issue. Apparently, the state has said it did not want to allow these license plates, and now they're going to court, Jeffrey.
They are indeed. This is a perennial problem that's been percolating up. The court has dodged this question repeatedly, and many people think that once again they may not confront the central question in this case.
Jeffrey Rosen, he's professor of law at George Washington University. David Savage of the LA Times. Barry Friedman of New York University School of Law. Short break, your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed, at aecf.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Last year, banks and credit unions collected $28 billion in overdraft charges, the latest on efforts to provide protection from excessive interest rates and fees. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to open the phones, first to Plymouth, Michigan. Good morning, Lynn. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks, Diane. There is an issue that I hope the panelists will do further research on, and that is the question of corporate personhood. This issue was not argued ever in the Supreme Court. The issue was contained in the head notes by court reporter J.C. Bancroft Davis, who wrote the following in the head notes, quote, "The defendant corporations are persons within the intent of the clause in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which forbids a state to deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Now, subsequently, in Tom Hartman's 2002 book on equal protection, he documents He found the evidence that this was not in the subsequent case. It was in the head notes.
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. Barry Friedman.
So there's an interesting story about corporate personhood, which was that the first time that it confronted the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice waved off the lawyer who was going to discuss the issue, saying there's no need to discuss it. We've already figured out what we think about it, that corporations will be treated as persons for certain reasons under the Constitution. I think this is a fascinating issue. I mean, Jeffrey was talking about the Campaign Finance Act, and certainly the conservatives would like to bring corporations into the realm of free speech and out from under these restrictions. And I think we saw Justice Sotomayor's opening salvo from the left, which is, if you want to go in that direction, maybe we should rethink this question of whether corporations are persons with regard to a number of provisions of the Constitution.
David.
The conservatives do have a pretty good response to that. As Justice Scalia noted during the argument, that a whole lot of the free speech precedents are things like New York Times versus Sullivan. New York Times is a corporation. There are a lot of these big cases that actually involve corporations. So it would be hard to go back the other way and say, under no circumstances can a corporation invoke, say, a free speech right.
But you could say that media corporations have different expressive interests than General Motors. And the caller is right. As a matter of history, that question of whether corporations were persons was never thoughtfully considered by the full court. This is the case that Ralph Nader is more upset about than anything else, the one that held corporations to be persons.
Interesting.
Just recently, a lower federal court said that corporations are persons for the purpose of having privacy rights. So it's true that conservatives are going to try to expand this, and liberals might try to cut it back.
All right. Here's a question from John from Seville, Ohio. Wonder what your panel's view is of Justice Clarence Thomas's ongoing silence from the bench. He enjoys a lifetime appointment, fine pay, benefits, courtesy of taxpayers. I think he owes it to the judicial system and to taxpayers to be a full participant in the court's oral arguments. Is it true, David Savage, that in 3 years, Justice Thomas has not asked a single question?
That's correct. He basically sits and listens to the arguments and does not participate in the exchanges. This question has been asked of him over a long time. It's been going on for 20 years. He says, you know, this job is about deciding legal issues and the briefs really cover the ground and you should sit and listen to the attorneys. I can listen to the argument. I don't have to participate. It is very odd. I mean, every time I've ever spoken to a student group, that's the first question they always ask is, what's wrong with Clarence Thomas? And he's heard it a lot, but he seems not to be comfortable of getting into a back and forth exchange. The arguments move very quickly. He likes to listen, but for some reason, he simply will not participate in the arguments.
Oral arguments are used to help probe the sensitive points in a case. And if you look at Clarence Thomas's jurisprudence, it's very dogmatic. I mean, he knows what he thinks about things, and it's very set and often not sensitive to nuance. So it's not crazy that you have nothing to ask about because he pretty much has a fixed understanding of where he thinks
the law
should go.
But I thought that the court was an opportunity to present various views, to consider them thoughtfully, rather than to come at this dogmatically.
Here's the polar opposite. Sonia Sotomayor asked 36 questions during the first hour of the first argument. So she's about as different. She really
and
wants
Scalia
to.
And Scalia asked 30.
That's exactly right. They really want to go back and forth with the attorneys and sort of probe what they think.
But if I could just put in a word for Justice Thomas, it's not fair to say that he's a disengaged member of the court who's not taking it seriously. I mean, his opinions are more provocative, more interestingly radical than certainly Justice Scalia on many of these questions. He was the only justice to dissent in that strip search case last year, the only one to dissent in the voting rights case. Now, his explanation is when he was a kid, he spoke a funny dialect called Gullah, and people made fun of him, and he was embarrassed about speaking in public. So for that reason, he's not comfortable with these exchanges, but he's very engaged legally and knows his own mind.
All right. To LaPorte, Indiana. Jenny, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Diana. Love your show.
Thank you.
Until I read David Savage's article in the Chicago Tribune, and I've been involved in animal welfare for years, I had no idea about the torture videos. I am confused how free speech can be equated with animal torture. It's confusing to me. The violence in our society is escalating. Torture is torture. And what's going to happen next? Is it going to lead to humans? I mean, I just don't understand it. The killing of Darian in Chicago a month ago, well, is that going to be excused?
Well, that's the issue in this case. By the way, everybody agrees that the law can and should try to stop animal cruelty. Dogfighting is illegal in all 50 states. And so the question here is, what if it's a video of the, and there's a long line of Supreme Court precedents that says videos are different. I do think, and I really hope, Diane, that a number of the justices sort of got the point about what this is really about. I think it's possible they're going to try to narrow this law to say it doesn't apply to things like photographs of bullfighting in Spain. It only applies to these horrific torture videos, and they'll try to maybe limit the law and say that can be banned.
The problem is the law has only been enforced three times since it was passed, and it's all been dogfighting stuff, not these crush videos that upset us the most of all. And if you just read it as it's written, it forbids conduct cruelly killing an animal that was illegal in the state in which the video was purchased, not where it was done. So you could have, Justice Breyer says, what about stuffing geese for pâté de foie gras? He had this wonderfully precious example. And the idea is, what if you kill an animal in a place where it's legal in a sort of cruel way, and then it's later bought someone else, you could be held liable. So it's a very poorly written law,
and
the justices could narrow it, but it'd be kind of hard to do it.
Yeah, you know, the analogy to child pornography, which is the one that those in favor of the law try to draw, the story with child pornography is that just allowing people to have these depictions or to sell these depictions creates a market for the production of child pornography, and nobody wants to do that. But with these animal cruelty, the hard question is that there's lots of film that shows depiction of animals dying in different ways, and so drawing the lines is very, very difficult, and David's shaking his head, but I think it's going to be hard for the court to narrow a statute that, when it doesn't have any guidance about where the narrowing would
happen.
I think
you can make a very clear argument that these videos are being made somewhere, perhaps outside the United States, and they're being...
I don't care where they're being
made.
That's
right, and they're being sold on the Internet. And the government's argument is that the way to stop... One way to stop this is make sure there's no profit, that nobody can make money... with these horrendous videos by selling them. So that is the argument.
Justice Ginsburg said the cockfight is going to take place whether there's a video of it or not, whereas in child pornography, it's the very act of creating the video that's illegal. So that's another tricky thing. If you really want to ban crush videos, you could do it more narrowly.
All right. Let's go to Skinny Atlas, New York. Jason, you're on the air.
Yeah. My comment was really about the Cross case, but as long as you're talking about the animals, there's a guy by the name of Upton Sinclair who wrote a novel not too long ago decrying some practices in the meatpacking industry. I think that's probably free speech and protected. It's a hard line. But in any event, moving on to the Cross case, it seems to me that that case involved the federal government recognizing that the monument as it stood violated the law, and in order to avoid the effect of the law, transferred the land. That seems to me kind of a backdoor way around the law and something that I don't think should be countenanced by the court.
That's probably what the dissenters will say. The four dissenters will say, this is obviously a ploy to keep this cross in the National Preserve, and it's unconstitutional because it's a ploy to get around constitutional ruling. My guess is the five more conservative justices are inclined to give the government more leeway to have religious symbols on public land, and that they will say the transfer basically resolved the problem.
Any other comments?
I mean, you could imagine, and the justices did imagine, cases where the caller's concerns would be clear. What if you just, the only thing you transferred was the tiny little spot of land
under
a symbol? That would seem to be clear pretext. But that raises much harder questions about whether an impermissible motive in a federal act itself should strike down the law for religious reasons, and that gets them into a big kettle of fish.
Let's go now to Essex, Connecticut. Good morning, Tracy.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling about the U.S. versus Stevens. And on Tuesday, Justice Breyer said something really interesting, which is, why not ask Congress to write a statute that bans these frightful things that we're talking about? So, for example, since child pornography is illegal, the act of filming it then becomes illegal. Why not ask Congress to write a statute that bans the gratuitous cruelty to animals? That would solve all the problems.
Certainly would.
Well, there's partly a problem there, which is whether the Congress of the United States has the jurisdiction to ban these kinds of animal cruelty. This is typically something that's believed to be within the authority of the states and not within the authority of the federal government. And there's been a separate fight on the Supreme Court about the reach of congressional authority and under what's called the Commerce Clause and whether this is even something Congress could do.
Although that gets us back to the morals question, and Justice Scalia, in a case involving medical marijuana, had said Congress's power to ban immoral acts is clear. Look at the Mann Act, which prohibited the taking of women across state lines for immoral purposes. So again, the liberals and conservatives are divided on this.
Here is an interesting email from Brian. He says, please explain the difference between depiction of hurting or killing people and animals in fictional films versus the real thing in crush snuff films. Would the video of the Chicago student be banned if the Stevens case prohibits violent videos? Is not the outrage at youth violence a direct result of seeing this awful video?
The direct answer is no, because this law says there's an exception for anything that has serious journalistic, artistic, educational value.
What is the educational value of seeing a young 14-year-old clubbed to death?
Well, I guess the news organization that would put it on say we wanted to show this, but I mean that would be the argument that they would say there's some journalistic value. If people thought it was just gratuitous cruelty for entertainment, which is what these crush videos are, then the law would clearly apply to that.
But are people watching this out of gratuitous entertainment? I mean, how do you all feel about
you've
this?
You've put your finger right on the problem, I think, which is, you know, in the very early days of pornography, when there were similar rules that governed what could be produced, pornography was put into this veil of, you know, sexual instruction for couples that needed help. And so these are mushy exceptions, and I think that's exactly the problem. And I think if Congress wants to do something about this, they're going to have to come in and state much more specifically what it is they think is the evil.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Did you want to add to it, Jeffrey?
Yes, Justice Rehm, because you were so unconvinced. You were just so indignant by this outrage.
I am indignant.
Well, Your Honor, I think what you're expressing is the fact that this is just prurient and voyeuristic, and it degrades people, and it's kind of an immoral thing to be entertained with this horrific act. But it is so interesting to me that neither side was willing to make that argument. Even the Obama administration just said, we have to chill the market for these videos. It was an empirical argument. No one's willing to say what you were saying with your facial expression right now and what the callers are saying, which is that there are some things that are so beyond the pale that they should be banned.
You know, I find it interesting to sit here and hear the distinction drawn between what's impermissible or what's just simply disgusting in these videos and bullfighting. But, I mean, one could take exactly the same approach about bullfighting,
exactly,
particularly if one's the bull.
Yeah, well, I take the same point. Let's go finally to Tom, who's in St. Louis. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Love the show.
Thanks.
A follow-up on the crosses. They speak of transferring the land, and the earlier caller mentioned that. What size parcel are they transferring, and are they willing to transfer land to anyone that wants to display a religious symbol, even pagan religions or non-religions? Can anybody ask for land?
I understand it's about 1 acre that they transfer to the VFW. It's where the cross is actually located. I don't think there are not a whole lot of religious symbols on public land, so this doesn't come up a whole lot of times. This was one way. This symbol went back to 1934.
Right.
They didn't know what to do with it, and this was a way to sort of get around the problem by transferring it to the VFW.
Any further comments on that? What do you see as the most important case before the court this term? Barry.
I think the election case is probably the most important case before the term. I think it's particularly that because my guess is there's a decent chance the court will actually strike down the congressional law, whereas in a number of these other cases, wow, I think there are ways for the court to duck.
David.
Agreed on that. I think there's a possibility they're going to say corporations have a free speech right to spend unlimited amounts of money on politics, and that will change national politics.
Wow.
I agree, and this will be a moment of truth for Chief Justice Roberts, because he came into office saying he wanted to be a minimalist, he wanted unanimity and consensus. He achieved that in the voting rights case. If he, by a narrow 5-4 vote, upholds, overturns decades of precedents and calls decades of laws into question, then that promise will be rather hollow.
Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University, David Savage of the L.A. Times, Barry Friedman of New York University School of Law, and author of the new book, The Will of the People. I apologize to all of you for my voice. I came back, I think, a bit too soon. Tomorrow, my good colleague, Susan Page, will be here sitting in for me. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.